Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are entitled Freedom, the Philosophy of Liberation. The speaker is Professor Dennis Dalton of Barnard College at Columbia University. Professor Dalton received his undergraduate degree from Rutgers University and his master's from the University of Chicago. He received his doctorate from the University of London in political theory. He has taught at Barnard College since 1969, where he now serves as the Ann Whitney Olin Professor of Political Science. Lecture 1, Freedom in the Ancient World.
This is a series of lectures about an idea. The idea of freedom. And I've called this first lecture Freedom in the Ancient World. It's about an idea and the men and the women, the books and the speeches that expound it. Our main purpose is to explain an idea that's familiar to us all, an idea that we all cherish and defend, to try to show why the idea of freedom has inspired people for thousands of years in vastly different cultures. When we approach this idea, we do it with some reverence, not only because we as Americans revere freedom, and we've often throughout our history given our lives for it, but also because we believe that ideas themselves have value, that ideas count in defining what we as Americans do and feel. When we use a term, as we often do, like the American way of life, we mean a life that is pursued according to certain values. And at the core of these values are ideas. Ideas such as equality and justice and law and civil rights, constitutionalism and democracy. But among these ideas, I think that none excels that of freedom. Even before the American Revolution, a revolution that was fought, of course, for freedom, people settled this country because they wanted freedom to escape from governments that tried to deprive them of freedom. So when we begin now to discuss freedom, we focus on the idea knowing that ideas matter and none matters more than freedom. I've titled this lecture, as I said, Freedom in the Ancient World, but I'll begin with a personal story. I want to illustrate how and when freedom came to matter most to me. In January 1961, when I was 22 years old, a long time ago, I was living in the villages of Nepal, a tiny kingdom, as you know, located just north of India in the lap of the Himalayas. I was there on a cultural exchange program that was run by 4-H clubs and the United States Department of Agriculture. It was a sort of pre-Peace Corps effort by America to send youth to foreign countries. At that moment in January, I was glued to a shortwave radio set, trying to hear my new president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, give his inaugural address. I remember the Voice of America describing Washington, D.C., on that day as being snow-covered, freezing cold and windy, the coldest January 20th in some time. It certainly was not like the jungles and the mountains of Nepal at that moment. I imagined then the thrill that must have swept through that crowd as they heard Kennedy begin. But I also imagined then, as I imagine now, that no one, no matter where they happened to be on that day, was more inspired than I by that magnificent speech. Never before or since has any political event moved me as much as this one did. I remember how, halfway around the world from Washington, the lump came into my throat when Kennedy declared, "To those peoples in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves for whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich." Now, that was sublime oratory. It hasn't been approached since in any inaugural that I've heard. But it wasn't that one passage that moved me most at that particular time. What moved me about Kennedy's address was its main theme, and that theme was the idea of freedom. Listen to the way that Kennedy emphasizes again and again throughout his speech his idea of freedom. He begins the speech with this line: "We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom." And then he continues with lines that have been quoted so often since: "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, and oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty." As he continues throughout this speech, we hear "free" and "freedom" repeated over and again. "To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny." And then again, "Let both sides unite to heed in all corners of the earth the command of Isaiah to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free." In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. And then he concludes, "My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man." If we go through this relatively brief inaugural address and circle the number of times that Kennedy uses freedom or free or liberty in it, it's clear that there is a dominant theme, and that is the idea of freedom. Now, when I reflect back to this speech, I realize that it was because of it that I became fascinated with the concept of freedom, with its meaning for the world, with its significance for us today in America. And so when I returned to the United States, I would write my PhD dissertation on the idea of freedom. Kennedy's speech, more than any other factor, made me see the central importance of that idea. And yet, while I think I was right about that, I was certainly wrong about another aspect of my reaction to that speech. And that is that I confess that at the time, as I listened to Kennedy, I thought that America had a monopoly on freedom, that this was our possession and we were about to give it to the rest of the world with a new frontier, that it was uniquely American. Well, I've learned since, as I'm sure you understand too, that this was a misunderstanding of mine that needs to be corrected, and I want to reply to that misunderstanding now by arguing that freedom, of course, is neither exclusively American or even exclusively Western, but that it has deep roots in the ancient world, beginning with the conceptualization of the idea in India, the very place, India, Nepal, South Asia, where I was at that moment listening to the inaugural in January 61. So we return to that place where the idea of freedom emerged 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. In ancient India, the early Hindu texts, especially the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is the so-called Bible of Hinduism. It means literally song of God. Both the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita set forth a concept, an idea of freedom that's defined in two senses. And both of these senses are contained in a single word. The word that the Hindus use is Swaraj, S-W-A-R-A-J. Now, if we break this word down into its two components, Swa and Raj, we find that Raj means rule over, and Swa means one's own. But this concept, this word, Swaraj, can be understood, as I said, in two ways. And I'll argue throughout these lectures that the two ways that the Indian philosophers understood freedom established the dual sense that freedom is often understood today. And let me explain this. On the one hand, they conceived of Swaraj, or freedom, in the strict political, the physical sense, as rule over one's own land or territory. And so you are free if your land or territory is not ruled by another, but by yourself. Swaraj, in that sense, which seems in the face of it to mean control, control over one's own territory, means freedom in the sense that you are free from alien rule. And that was a key way that the early Indians used the term Swaraj, or the idea of freedom. A prince, a maharaja, possessed Swaraj, or a person possessed Swaraj, if those individuals lived in a land that was free from alien control. But there was another way in which they used this concept of Swaraj, another way in which they understood freedom. Swaraj was also understood in the Upanishads and in the Bhagavad Gita in a spiritual or a psychological sense, as rule over one's soul or rule over one's self. And so, through self-knowledge, one acquires a certain kind of spiritual liberation. That is, one becomes, through knowing oneself, free in the sense of being free from ignorance of oneself and of the world, free from illusion, and free from fear. Now, that kind of psychological freedom or spiritual freedom carried strong connotations. That is, it meant that one was unfree if one was obsessed with money or possessions of things, because these create a kind of bondage or addiction. So the Bhagavad Gita says that the truly free person acts without craving or possessiveness, and finds inner peace by being, as the Gita says, freed from delusion. The highest level of consciousness, therefore, is when we learn that our individual being is at one with all being. Through self-knowledge, we understand that our self is at one with all selves. And in this awareness of the unity of all being comes spiritual liberation. Those are the lines from the Upanishads. Finally, the freest person, therefore, the Upanishads tell us, and the Gita, is the person who sees all being in himself and himself in all being. Now, how is this freedom? It's liberation. Liberation from a sense of alienation from others, from divisiveness. And since a sense of alienation and separateness and divisiveness breed fear, then we are liberated from fear. We achieve freedom from a psychological burden of anxiety and fear when we understand our harmony and unity with others. There's a story that's told in the Upanishads that illustrates the way in which the highest kind of freedom is attained. The story goes like this. A person enters a darkened room. He needs to obtain something from that room. but he's fearful because he sees in the corner of the room an object. And that object that he sees seems to be a snake. There's a form there, sort of quivering, and he imagines it as a cobra. So he flees the room in fear. But he needs that object in the room. So he goes back to it, and there's more light. And he sees that perhaps it isn't a snake at all. Perhaps it's something else. But he can't be sure, so he decides he'll wait until there's still more light, and he leaves the room to come back again. He comes back, and the room is fully lit. And he sees that it wasn't a snake at all. It was a rope hanging there. And he retrieves his object, but he moves about the room, as we may move about the world when we're in tune with ultimate reality, without fear. The dispelling of fear, then, is a result of greater vision, of more light, of a kind of enlightenment that can show us that the object that we thought was a snake, or perhaps a stranger, or an enemy, was not that at all. Rather, that object is simply something of which we need no, have no fear, and we're free. Fear, then, from the Upanishadic point of view, is one of the greatest threats to us, and we are in bondage to it. But what we must do is liberate ourselves with vision and light, understand that there is no reason to be afraid. That in fact, if we will look deeply and fully with the light that we need, we'll see that the rope is only that and not a snake at all. Now, this is an important concept, the idea of Swaraj, the idea of freedom in the Hindu world, as I said, 1,000 years before Christ. And we want to review it now and make sure that we've got it straight, because it's more or less the paradigm, the model that I'll be using for much of what follows, in which we'll see that a group of theorists who conceive the idea of freedom in the Western world are working within this idea of freedom in a dual sense. That is, freedom in an external sense and freedom in an internal sense. And one complements the other. So let's return to the idea as we have it in India, as set forth in the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. First of all, Swaraj means, in a strict political sense, control over one's country, freedom from foreign rule. Second, it means, in a spiritual sense, or a moral sense, or we might say in a psychological or an internal sense, not control over one's country, but control over oneself, one's soul. And that comes from self-knowledge, as well as from knowledge of the unity of being all around us. We are all part of life on this planet. We are all part of one another. And this discovery of what the Hindus like to call unity in diversity frees us from the illusions that divide or addict us. Frees us from the illusion that another individual is an enemy, frees us from the addiction, say, to property that allows us to find security in accumulation of things. These two meanings of freedom, then, political and spiritual, internal and external, they'll be found in several of the other philosophers of freedom that we'll be considering later in these lectures, but it's clear in the theories of freedom set forth in India, and then a few centuries later, in ancient Greece. So we turn now from India to ancient Greece to see how the philosophy of freedom was set forth there. In ancient Greece, freedom meant, first of all, political or external freedom, as it did in India. Now, this is clearest in the writings of the Greek historian Thucydides, perhaps the finest of all historians. Certainly, if we group Thucydides with Herodotus, we have two of the most magnificent historians that not only the ancient world, but the history of the world has produced. Thucydides wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. That is, the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta that occurred in 5th century B.C. He includes in this history a speech a magnificent oration by the Athenian general and political leader Pericles. Pericles was leader of the Athenians and so successful that we call the 5th century BC in Athens the golden age of Pericles. So prominent was he that for 30 years he managed to control or to influence the assembly, the key ruling body in Athens. And it was Pericles that inspired democracy in Athens. Pericles, who died in the plague in 429 BC at the beginning of the war between Athens and Sparta, led Athens into that war and did not survive long. And one might say that that was one reason why Athens lost the war. It was Pericles, with his unparalleled eloquence, that acclaimed the free and open nature of Athenian political life, as he called it. He said that Athens, in contrast to the oppressive statism of Sparta, is free and tolerant in our public and private lives. And because of this, our city, the apostle of freedom, he called it, is an education to all of Greece. The meaning of freedom in Pericles' oration, then, is the ability to act without any hindrance, just as long as you're obeying the law and not harming others. And that concept of freedom, we might call it the liberal notion of freedom, or the external idea of freedom, the political concept of freedom, that concept of freedom is at the key of what he says in this oration, and indeed the key to which of what most Greeks thought about freedom. After Thucydides and Pericles came the greatest of the Greek philosophers, Plato. Plato, of course, the author of the profound work, The Republic, written in 375 BC. By this time, by the time Plato wrote The Republic, Athens had lost the war to Sparta, had executed Socrates, had begun its long decline. Plato believed that this decline could be attributed to its democracy and the way in which democracy defined freedom. So in the Republic, he condemns democracy. He sees the democratic idea of freedom as the fatal flaw that has corrupted the Athenian polity. Based on Plato's own direct experience with Athenian democracy as a young man of a prominent family that had been involved in politics, Plato reflected back on his thoughts at age 18, and I quote from a letter that Plato wrote towards the end of his long life. Plato died at age 80, and towards the end of his life, he reflected back on how he felt about politics at age 18, and he said this: "When I was young, I had the same experience that comes to so many. I thought that as soon as I should be my own master, I should enter public life. This intention was favored by certain circumstances in the political situation at Athens. But unfortunately, some of the men in power in Athens brought my dear friend Socrates to trial on an abominable charge, the very last that could be made against Socrates, the charge of corrupting the youth. He was condemned and he was put to death. When I considered this, and all the things that it suggested, the men who were directing public affairs, what they had done to my friend, I made a closer study, as I grew older, of law and custom, and the harder it seemed to me to govern a state rightly, and certainly I knew Athens was not being governed that way. The whole fabric in Athens of law and custom was going from bad to worse at an alarming rate. The result was that I, who had at first been full of eagerness for a public career, when I saw all this happening and everything going to pieces, fell at last into utter bewilderment. I did not cease to think in what way this situation might be amended, and in particular the whole organization of the state, but I was all the while waiting for the right opportunity for action." Well, that opportunity never came. Plato remained disillusioned. He wrote the Republic as an ideal, to recommend that ideal to the Greek world and to history, because we still read it avidly today, 2,300 years later. But that ideal was never realized. And Plato, although he was a superb educator, never became an activist. But what was it about the system of democracy and the idea of democratic freedom in particular in the 5th century BC Athens? What was it exactly about this system that antagonized Plato? Well, if we look at the system of democracy in Athens at this time, we see that from about 480 to 380 BC, Athens had a remarkable cultural achievement in philosophy and literature, in science, and in architecture. In terms of dramatists alone, the list is astounding. Sophocles, Euripides, Aeschylus, Aristophanes, dramatists who all composed during this time and produced plays that we still study and sometimes still produce today. One historian has said that Athens during this time represented the highest level of civilization that has ever existed. So what was Plato complaining about? Plato condemned the democratic system per se, the free democracy that Pericles had praised as Athens' finest product. Now, what exactly was this democracy like? We may say that compared to our democracy in America, it was both less and more than we have attained. It was less because it was so much smaller. In area, the city-state of Attica, of which Athens was the principal city, was only the geographical size of Rhode Island. And its population was only about 360,000 people. Moreover, they achieved so much less than we did because Athens had slaves, and they relied heavily on slave labor. That is, 100,000 of this population of 360,000 were slaves, over a quarter of the population. So the democracy was ruled by a citizen class of about 160,000 people. And of those 160,000, only 40,000, the males, could exercise political rights. So we had a restricted, limited democracy. Only the men of a certain citizen class could rule. And yet, with all these restrictions, we can still say that in some respects, Athens achieved more than we have in terms of democracy. Now, first of all, it was the first democratic system in the world. And it was the only democracy in the ancient world of that time and for some time to come. Unlike us today, of course, we've built on other democracies. Second, and this is a strong point for Athenian democracy, it was a direct democracy as far as the 40,000 male citizens went. That is, the sovereign rule of the state came from an assembly which consisted officially of every adult Athenian male. This was the sole legislative body, meeting once a month, and a quorum of 6,000 citizens was necessary. Any citizen could speak and propose anything, and there were no property or literacy qualifications. All of this meant that there was an extraordinarily high involvement of citizens in political affairs. And there was indeed free as well as direct participation. So Pericles can say in his oration, and this is another line from his speech, in Athens, each individual is interested not only in his own affairs, but in the affairs of the state as well. Even those who are mostly occupied with their own businesses are extremely well informed on general politics. So we do not say that a man who takes no interest in politics is a man who minds his own business. We say that he has no business here at all. This is the uniqueness of our state, Pericles concluded. We enter into free discussions on all matters of politics. Well, once again, if Athens was so great in terms of its democracy, what was Plato's complaint? Much of Athens' political system has to seem admirable from our perspective, apart from its slavery and other restrictions, considering the fact that this was 2,400 years ago, in a world given to despotisms, Athens was in some part an admirably free and democratic political system. Plato's critique begins with what he calls the main symptoms of the rot that he sees at the core of his state. And there were two symptoms, from his point of view, primarily. The first was the Peloponnesian War, and the second was the execution of Socrates. The Peloponnesian War, fought between Athens and Sparta, brought the whole Greek world in and utterly devastated it. It was the longest, the costliest war that Greece ever fought. From Plato's viewpoint, the war was caused by Athens' arrogance, what he continually returns to the sin of hubris. And when Athens lost it, from his point of view, it got exactly what it deserved. Plato gradually determined that the problem with Athenian democracy then was that it was so democratic. Popular judgment, as we can see in the decisions made about the war, was very often wrong. And why was it wrong? Because the average person is unthinking and unreflective. All wars, Plato said, are made for making money, and people can always be manipulated, as they were in Athens, in a democracy, into supporting war by the economic interests of the state. But it was not only the war. The execution of Socrates in 399 BC devastated Plato, as the war had devastated the Greek world. It was another symptom of this fatal flaw in Athenian democracy, because when we look back at the execution, the trial, conviction, and execution of Socrates, we see that Socrates was condemned to his death not by a group of tyrants, a small elite, a military junta. Socrates was condemned to death by his peers, by a jury of over 100 Athenians. Plato was 28 years old when he witnessed this trial. He was helpless to reverse the verdict. He had studied with Socrates for 10 years during an extremely formative period from ages 18 to 28, and he never recovered from this loss of his best friend and teacher. But he registered his criticisms of democracy throughout the Republic as a system of government that was inevitably ruled by a majority of ignorant and unfeeling people, short-sighted, incapable of rational decisions or vision, and usually manipulated by a small group of demagogues or politicians who claimed to represent them, but were in fact only concerned with wielding their own power. And there is no end to a politician's lust for power. They have an insatiable appetite for control, and they become addicted to it. And they justify their position, these demagogues in the assembly, these politicians who in their cheap, petty way rationalize their position by calling it a free and democratic system. It's a system, Plato said, ruled by money. Now, Plato devotes a whole chapter in the Republic to the evils of democracy and what Democrats call democratic freedom. In the Democracy, he says, freedom is mere license. That is, people are given permission to do whatever they like with no sense of social responsibility or political obligation. Plato wanted as his ideal state not a democracy, but what he called a meritocracy, where leaders are qualified through a rigorous system of education and would therefore, hopefully, rule wisely, because intellectual achievement and not financial power or popularity got people into public office. Plato's theory is often expressed in parables, allegories, analogies. So let's look at some examples of these, beginning with his parable of the ship of state, as it's called. And then we'll turn to his analogy between the free person and the free state. To go then to the Republic. Plato didn't call this the ship of state parable. It's been called since by scholars and politicians. Abraham Lincoln referred to it, for example, as the ship of state parable. And it's a parable that describes democracy in free Athens. We imagine a ship. Imagine, Socrates says, this state of affairs on board a ship, or a number of ships. The master is bigger and burlier than any of the crew, but a little deaf and short-sighted and no less deficient in seamanship. The sailors are quarreling over the control of the helm. Each thinks he ought to be steering the vessel, though he has never learnt navigation and cannot point to any teacher under whom he has served his apprenticeship. What is more, they assert that navigation is a thing that cannot be taught at all, and are ready to tear in pieces anyone who thinks it can. Meanwhile, they besiege the master himself, begging him urgently to trust them with the helm. And sometimes, when others have been more successful in gaining his ear, they kill them or throw them overboard. And after somehow stupefying the worthy master with strong drink or an opiate, they take control of the ship. They make free with its stores. They turn the voyage, as might be expected of such a crew, into a drunken carousal. Besides all this, they cry up as a skilled navigator and master of seamanship anyone clever enough to lend a hand in persuading or forcing the master to set them in command. Every other kind of man they condemn as useless. They do not understand that the genuine navigator can only make himself fit to command the ship by studying the seasons of the year, sky, stars, winds, and all that belongs to his craft. And they have no idea that along with the science of navigation, it's possible for him to gain by instruction or practice the skill to keep control of the helm, whether or not some of them like it. If a ship were managed in that way, would not those on board be likely to call the expert in navigation a mere stargazer who spent his time in idle talk and was useless to them? I think you understand, then, what I mean, and do not need to have my parable interpreted in order to see how it illustrates the attitude of existing states towards the true philosopher. Well, even though Plato says that we don't need to interpret his parable, it's interpreted briefly, and that is that the master in this parable, who is a little deaf and short-sighted, represents the sovereign people. The master is easily fooled by the crew representing the politicians and demagogues whom Plato has seen take over. Notice that Plato refers to the sovereign people as the master, because in a democracy, the sovereign people are supposedly the ones in control of the state, but they have a problem. They're short on vision. Their senses are inadequate, particularly their ability to reason. So the crew given only to a lust for power, they take over the ship and throw the whole voyage into a drunken carousal. That is the archetypal quintessential politician. And from Plato's point of view, the crew then is representative of what would happen on the kind of voyage, the same kind of voyage that Athens took when it lost the war to Sparta in 404 BC. From Plato's point of view, this is the essence of democracy. Number one, the master or the sovereign people, unintelligent. Number two, the crew or the politicians who are given only to a lust for power, to controlling that master. And number three, the force that's not given any weight in this, that's dismissed by Plato as incapable of handling a democracy, the navigator or the philosopher. In a true state, in a model state from Plato's point of view, we must have a philosopher rule, just as in an ideal voyage, a navigator has influence over the course of the ship, its destination, and ultimately its arrival at a safe harbor. From Plato's point of view, this is the problem with freedom in a democracy. It's not freedom at all, it's just license. The master thinks that he has freedom, but in fact, the master is easily deluded by the politician who has real control in terms of manipulating that democracy. And so the state is acclaimed as a free and democratic system until it hits the rocks. And once then that happens, the verdict is clear, just as it was clear in Athens, as it lost that magnificent culture to unreason, to irrationality, to the manipulation of the many by a few. Well, Plato talks about freedom and democracy in that context. He speaks of freedom and democracy in other contexts as well. He draws an analogy between the state and the individual towards the end of the book in terms of the just and the unjust individual and the just and the unjust state. And Socrates is speaking now to one of his young followers, Glaucon, And in the analogy that Socrates draws, he says this: bearing in mind, then, the analogy between state and individual, you shall tell me what you think of the condition of each in turn. To begin with the state, is it free under a despot or is it enslaved? It's utterly enslaved. It's degraded to a miserable slavery, Glaucon says, even the best men in it. If the individual, then, is analogous to the state, we shall find the same order of things in him. A soul laboring under the meanest servitude, the best elements in it being enslaved, while a smaller part, which is also the most frenzied and corrupt, plays the master. Would you call such a condition of the soul, then, freedom or slavery? Slavery, of course. And just as a state enslaved to a tyrant cannot do what it really wishes, so neither can a soul under a similar tyranny do what it wishes as a whole. Goaded on against its will by the sting of desire, it will be filled with confusion and remorse. Like the corresponding state, it must always be poverty-stricken, unsatisfied, haunted by fear. Nowhere else will there be so much lamentation, groaning, and anguish as in a country under a despotism and in a soul maddened by the tyranny of passion. Therefore, throughout life, the despotic character has not a friend in the world. He is sometimes master, sometimes slave, but never knows true friendship or freedom. While the freest man is he who is first in goodness and justice, namely the true king, who is also king over himself. Well, that's Plato's view, that the free person in a free state will be in a state that is controlled by reason, just as the free person within himself will have a soul that is not dominated by fear and passion, but by reason. This is Plato's judgment, then, on democratic Athens, and this is his commendation of the kind of freedom that he wants. Now, finally, there is a third view of freedom, briefly, that came from the ancient world. It came from the ancient world after the Indian and the Greek. It was the Christian. 400 years after Plato, Christ expounded a philosophy of spiritual freedom. In the Gospel, according to St. John, chapter 8, Christ's idea of freedom is expressed in these words: "Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, If ye continue in my word, then are ye my disciples indeed. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make ye free. They answered him, We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, Ye shall be made free? Jesus answered them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, Whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin, and the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the Son abideth forever. If the Son, therefore, shall make you free, you shall be free indeed." Now, this concept of freedom set forth by Christ, that is, that the truth shall make you free, was developed further by the great Catholic theologian, St. Augustine, who wrote in the 5th century, "The will is truly free when it is not the slave of vices, passions, and sins." That Christian view of freedom, then, means this: that the truth shall make you free. Like Plato and the Indian Hindu philosophers, Christ believed that there were two forms of freedom. The first form of freedom was not connected with the perception of any particular kind of truth. It meant acting in a social and political sense, as the Romans did, for example, conceiving of freedom in the sense that one had power to control others and assert themselves over their own political sovereignty. That was not the kind of freedom that concerned Christ most, because the second kind of freedom depended for Christ, as for the Hindus and for Plato, on the knowledge of a moral or spiritual truth. For Christ, as for the Hindus, this was a religious truth, a truth about God. And by grasping this truth, one could attain the highest freedom from sin, freedom from illusion, freedom from ignorance, freedom from fear. Now, there are, of course, immense differences among these three views of freedom, because conceptions of what is the truth differ among the Indians, Plato, and Christ. But let's look to the similarities among these three views. First, all three, the view set forth in India, the view set forth at length in Greece, and the view set forth in this one passage by Christ and developed later by theologians like St. Augustine, those three views all distinguish between a lower and a higher form of freedom. The higher being freedom from fear and ignorance, a freedom that allows one to see a greater truth, greater than just being free to act as one wishes. It is, in fact, a perception of reality that allows us to act as we should, according to a disciplined and a responsible knowledge of ourselves. It's a freedom that, in the highest sense, sees desire for money and property as obstacles to truth. We're free when we have transcended addiction to material possessions, and so are liberated to pursue a higher truth. So this is how the ancient world perceived freedom. And although it may seem different from forms of democratic freedom as we practice them today, I think that the essence of the higher form of freedom is probably captured by John Fitzgerald Kennedy in the inaugural speech with which we began, when he said, "My fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Plato defined freedom in this way. Freedom is not license. It's acting with responsibility, with self-control, with enlightenment, a way that is consistent with duty and not contrary to it. But as we'll see as we move through these lectures, there is inevitably a tension between the democratic form of freedom and Plato's call to social responsibility. And we'll continue to explore some of the implications of this tension in the next lectures.